to Techno Roll, a special Let It Roll maxi series discussing Simon Reynolds' book Energy Flash, a journey through rave music and dance culture, hosted by Nate Wilcox and Ryan Harkness. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate and Ryan discuss EDM's sudden explosion of popularity in the United States in the 2010s. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll, or should I say Techno Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and I'm joined by Ryan Harkness as we wrap up our discussion of Simon Reynolds' book Energy Flash, which I don't have in front of me, and I forgot the subtitle, but we're on the final chapter from the 2013 edition, which is called The Future Is Now, EDM in the USA, or 2012, the year rave broke America. Ryan, did rave really break America?
I mean, it broke in America. But before we get into that, I'm just curious as to, I want to clarify this for people who are following along with the book maybe, and they're looking at the book and they're saying, where is this chapter? Because our copies of the book don't have the chapter. This was kindly sent to us by Simon Reynolds. But does it exist in any of the physical or digital copies of
yes.
Yeah.
I believe it's from the 2013 edition, which we have the 2012 edition. And it's got a pink cover on Amazon. So I wasn't aware, or for whatever reason, I thought that was the older edition. And that's why I bought the 2012 edition. It's also slightly more expensive and I'm cheap. But yeah, I think it's the 2013 edition. And that's available. And both of the editions seem to be in print on Amazon. So that's... Yeah,
for anybody following along with the Black Book, this is why instead of us moving forward into a chapter, which was an interview with Simon Reynolds, and we're going to do much better. We're actually going to interview Simon Reynolds next week and get our own interview in. But instead, we're doing this very mysterious Futures Now, EDM in the USA, or 2012, the year rave broke America. And it did. It broke into America, and it broke America in a lot of ways. And it finally did what everybody was waiting for it to do for about 15 years, which was hit the mainstream in a big way.
And that it did.
And move units and make money, which is the most important thing as far as everybody is concerned, apparently.
Yes, moving units and making money. I mean, you know, as NWA said, that's what life's all about or something. But so Reynolds starts the chapter out by returning to the United States in August of 2012. This is the first time he's been to a big rave in the States since 1996. And we talked about that. That was a rave up in Wisconsin. I'm blanking on the name. But he goes to the Hard Summer Festival in L.A. in August 2012. And the first thing he sees is a sign that says no backpacks, no dolls, no toys, no candy with a K, no plush or furry items, no glow sticks, light gloves, or other light toys, no bandanas, gas masks, or pacifiers. What is this all about?
For Hard specifically, it's as much an aesthetic decision as it was a legal decision. For a while after old Joe Biden passed a rave law in America, you could get into serious trouble just for having, you know, Vicks VapoRub or soothers and stuff like that. They would see this as drug paraphernalia and be able to really come down hard legally on everybody. But at this point, by 2012, it's a bit different. And a lot of this stuff about no candy, no plush or furry items and stuff like that was more the organizers of Hard Summer Festival trying to put a specific aesthetic, implement a look onto the event. Their Hard events were kind of a response to Electric Daisy Carnival being the real flower power event. Hard events, they wanted people to show up looking hard and ready to rage. So it's like a 50-50. It's a bit of a throwback to what was going on in 2007, where like legally they couldn't allow this stuff in. And now it was more of just, it was a choice. It was like a dress code.
I see. And as Reynolds says, the promoters realized the only way for their company to survive in the face of hostility from local politicians and police was to put as much distance as possible between themselves and rave's daft disreputable past. But once he gets in there, he says it still looks an awful lot like a rape. And I mean, in no time at all, he's describing some girl dancing in front of her stoned boyfriend with her lights, you know, her light gloves. So, you know, the rules are honored in the breach as well. He says the biggest differences are that the boy's pants aren't as crazy stupid wide, which is a good thing. And the girls have sexed up their look considerably. So, you know, the politics of that, I'll leave to somebody else to debate. But he also says that while I came across a fair few people off their faces, that's British for I saw a lot of people who were screwed up on drugs, quote, the overall atmosphere is less overtly druggy than it used to be back in the day. So that's the sort of cultural setting. Then he gets to the music and he says there's something else different about hard and EDM. And EDM doesn't appear in the book, really. I mean, EDM has become a term for all electronic dance music, which is what it stands for. But it's also describing a particular kind of electronic dance music that suddenly became very popular early in the 2010s. He calls it the ungainly term that's now replaced techno. But back to the music, he's saying on a formal level, the beats and riffs and the way the music is put together and the way it moves, it doesn't seem that different from the rave floor fare of the 90s and early 2000s. What's different is the overall sound through which everything is sluiced, ferociously digital, a flat glare, depthless and dazzling. Staring up at the giant speaker stacks of the main hard stage, I suddenly felt they were iPod earbuds blown up to immense scale. So do you get what he's talking about with the sound?
Yeah, I do. But at the same time, I feel like this might be a point where Simon Reynolds is starting to show his own age. I mean, a lot of people who came into the scene in the 90s felt the same way about the electronic music being created then because it was so kind of different and plastic and robotic. So all of a sudden now you've got this new level of technological, you know, grease like slapped on top of it. And now it's making him feel a little bit uncomfortable and out of touch. And, you know, I understand kind of what he's saying, but at the same time, there's a lot of things that are, I call this kind of the Joe Rogan problem, where he's not specifically saying there's anything wrong with it, but you can kind of hear in the tone and how he asks his questions or makes his statements that there's a little bit of disapproval in it. And, you can kind of read between the lines as to where his position really is. And I just don't find the negativity in, you know, this new plastic sheen that he's talking about, this, bubble, this plastic wrap that we've put over all the music.
So somewhere between old man yells at cloud and you kids get off my lawn. Is that
a little bit?
Okay. All right. And he does point out that only one of the DJs at the Hardfest used turntables. Everybody else used CDJs. What's a CDJ?
CDJ is just, you know, even CDJs are out of use now because CDJs are compact disc players that you stick the CD in. And at that point, after that, it's pretty much like a digital turntable with a jog wheel on top that replaces the platter. And these days, you know, you can even get them without, you know, a CD slot on them and you just stick a USB in the corner. So they're not, you know, USB DJ didn't really catch on as a term. They're just CDJ.
I don't know why.
I was using CDJs right back in 1998, where it was basically looked like a gigantic black box with buttons on it. So I'm an old hat when it comes to that gear, and I'm really liking the new stuff that's out now. That it basically, in form and function, looks almost like a turntable, but it's all just digital now.
I see, and also he says that Ableton Live is the alternative to CDJs. What's Ableton Live?
You know, it's mainly a digital audio workstation to produce music in. Some people use it as a DJ or performance tool. I find DJs that use it very boringly most of the time. They'll put like just, you know, the entire track in one channel and then the next one in another, and it all locks the groove in and makes it really easy to mix. But live performers can, you know, slice their tracks down into 100 different components and assign them to buttons on a controller and really create a symphony with them. So it's an iffy, like guys like Sasha apparently were doing great things with Ableton, but you know, if you take a closer look at what he was doing, it was really just a decent amount of crossfading as far as I'm concerned.
I see. And let's go ahead and hear our first song. This is Zed with Stay the Night featuring Hayley Williams. And that was Zed featuring Hayley Williams doing Stay the Night. And why did you pick this track?
I was trying to create that feeling when you walk into one of these big rave festivals, the kind of sound that you would hear in 2012. The Zed sound is very much a spiritual successor to the uplifting trance sound that was so big, but it's become much more pop oriented. So, and as Simon Reynolds was talking about in this chapter, it all kind of got put under this weird electro house umbrella, but it doesn't really stay there very effectively. It's all bubbling and boiling and trying to get out. And I thought Zed Stay the Night was a good example of that, where you listen to it and go, this is not what it's being touted as, but you know, the best way to say it is it is the big uplifting EDM festival sound.
Yeah, when I first heard Zed, and not that track in particular, but any Zed, and heard it described as electro house, I was waiting for the 808s and the Four on the Floor, and it sounded more like trance to me. So,
well, this is another situation where guys on Beatport, that old MP3 selling site where all the DJs get their stuff from, were producing electro house, like legit proper electro house. And then over a year, 2 years, 3 years, their sound, you know, slowly corrupted into whatever mainstream dance music wanted it to be. But their genre remained stuck in that electro house category on the Beatport site. And so the tail starts wagging the dog. because it's in the electro house section, it's called electro house, but it's not really electro house anymore. It's just kind of there was no better name for it at the time, so it was just categorized wrong, and now we're just doing it wrong.
It seems like people are remembering it more as EDM.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Like that's the big catch-all for the American sound, all the commercialized festival music that was coming out at the time. There's the even bigger, more headbangy Four to the Floor stuff is known as Big Room House, if people want to get specific and want to find more of that. But yeah, EDM is kind of a useful catch-all.
Okay, and the other big technological development was some software, which like FL Studio, formerly known as Fruity Loops, which I think a lot of the grime makers were using Fruity Loops in our last chapter, and Logic. And Reynolds, again, goes back to makes everything sound sort of encased in glass, like it's all been shellacked. And that's kind of a pejorative, but I do think there's some descriptive power to it, that they are using incredible amounts of compression and getting a really big sound. He quotes a DJ saying that it's descended from that roaring Justice sound. Justice is a French group, I think we mentioned last week, a combination of a sidechain compression, the squeezing pumping sound, and brick wall limiting. And brick wall limiting is, if you look at the sound waves on a graph, it'll look like a block. You won't see ups and downs of the dynamics. As the sound gets louder and quieter, everything is loud.
If you look at music from the 60s, 70s, 80s and stuff like that, if you look at the waveform of that, there's peaks and valleys, and it looks kind of like an earthquake. Lots of big squigglies for loud parts and lots of small ones for small. And now there's something called the sausage. And the sausage is when you look at the waveform, and it basically has kind of like the ends of the sausage, which are the only narrow parts, and then it's all thick and fat all through the middle. And that is the new maxed out, limited, compressed up sound that's expected in order to break through the noise of modern society.
Yeah, and lots of rock groups actually do it. The Jimi Hendrix reissues are bricked out. Metallica has been bricking their stuff for a long time. I think that the game there is, when your track comes up on shuffle on somebody's headphones, it sounds louder than the track before it, or at least as loud as the track before it. The Guy Reynolds quote says, it's literally designed to make older people's ears hurt. So always fun, always fun. And then it's also a sound associated with cocaine and study drugs like Adderall. So and we'll talk about other drugs. I think ketamine is the other sound that we'll be talking about in this period, but definitely cocaine and Adderall are very present in this era. And so, like you mentioned, electro house was the dominant style at Hard Summer. You had Zedd. You also had Errol Aiken, Bloody Beetroots. Reynolds says that their sound was descended from Daft Punk's Discovery album, and then further developed by Justice and Digitalism, and popularized by deadmau5 in the United States massively. And deadmau5, the guy running around with the giant plastic mouse head on his head, that him?
Yeah.
All right, good. Even the old guys know about deadmau5.
You listen to Daft Punk's Discovery and you say, how did it get us here? Justice, it starts to make a bit more sense. And Digitalism is really the group that they're kind of like, you know, how we're going to get into this later about how Skrillex kind of was the bro step link, you know, between everything. Digitalism is the group that took that kind of smooth, sexy French touch electro sound and then really took it out for a rip roar and put, you know, 9,000 RPM ride. And from there, everybody else kind of followed that and into the festival land. And it was so hyperactive and intense and everything else like that, that it became a template. And that's why, you know, it's kind of Adderall induced, cocaine induced, because it's so hype.
Yeah. And I think it's also getting to, and he'll talk about this more later, but when you're playing to this size of audience, it's going to change the music. There's no way to do small, intimate, sophisticated sounds in a stadium setting. You've got to reach for the rafters and turn full Bono, you know, and do the big U2 grand gesture thing. You need to channel your inner Freddie Mercury if you're going to be playing, you know, to 350,000 people in Vegas over 2 days. And the other big style is dubstep or bro step, as it was named as a pejorative. But I find bro step is just way more descriptive, because dubstep is an actual thing that we talked about last chapter that's almost the exact opposite of what dubstep became popularly known as in this period.
Yeah, I mean, you really had to give it another name. And I mean, I know that dubstep, the US bro step sound won the dubstep battle and they now own the term dubstep. But you know, when you're going to go through it forensically and historically, like we are, we got to separate the two and give dubstep back to the British people who invented it and mastered it, and give this new sound something, descriptive. And bro step works.
Yeah, and they even like it themselves. So, you know, it started out as a way to knock the style, but it was taken on. It was appropriated back by the people who were being slurred. And he points out, you know, it wasn't just Skrillex. There's also Datsik, 12th Planet in the States, Flux Pavilion, Rusko in the UK. Has very little, like we said, to do with the sound of groups like Burial or Digital Mystics that were the original dubstep. Reynolds says the original dubsteps honored roots reggae, jungle, speed garage, used vinyl, where brostep circulates as audio files, has a very much, you know, the future is now, the sound is dense, it's in-your-face digitalism. And Skrillex had been on the smaller stage in 2011, but by 2012, he's the headliner for the whole festival, putting on a massive audio-visual spectacle. Reynolds says that it really sounds to him more like slowed down drill and bass, which was a sort of Smarty Pants parody style of jungle and drum and bass that people like Aphex Twin and others were doing in the late 90s. It's kind of an artsy fartsy thing. But he says, you know, that the original dubstep was kind of slowed down jungle, and this is slowed down drill and bass, and that Skrillex is very formulaic. He likes Skrillex. Go ahead.
I'm just wondering if he forgot about his whole journey where he took us from jungle into speed garage and speed garage into dubstep. So that's kind of the route that it actually took.
Yeah, I doubt he forgot that, but he's, you know, compressing. Whenever you look back, you got to telescope the past. And Steph's telling me it's time to play another track. So let's hear Downlink's Raw Power.
Power. Light.
that was Downlink's Raw Power from 2012. Why did you pick that one?
Oh, I feel like everybody already is familiar with the Skrillex Bro Step sound. 75% of basically what was going on at the dubstep stages and stuff like that. But I thought I'd give a little taste of the other 25% of dubstep that was getting a bit more experimental and led into the entire bass genre that is still kicking now. So this is bro step. This is dubstep bro step stuff, but it's really getting to a point where it's getting very sonically stranger than just a stereotypical dubstep growl or wobble.
Yeah. And pointing towards the future, and he'll talk about this sort of bro step as one of the few genres in this period having what we would consider like a traditional linear development through time rather than just kind of mushing around. But we'll talk about that a little bit more later. Let's talk about Skrillex a little bit. He was 24 in 2013. His name's Sonny Moore. He came out of the hardcore punk scene. He'd been a frontman in some screamo bands. And Reynolds says that the three major developments of this chapter, meaning the period from 2007 to 2012 in dance music, mesh in this one person. So he's kind of the personification of the era. One, the unexpected resurgence of rave in the U.S., which dwarfed all previous peaks of popularity. And, you know, if you are an investor and you'd sold electronic dance music futures when Reynolds sold it to in 2007, you would have lost out on some major growth in this period because he thought it had peaked forever in the 1998 to 2000 boom. Well, he was wrong. Number two is the surprising rise of dubstep, aka brostep, even as it's gotten more extreme and aggressive. I thought this was a really interesting aspect. I mean, except for the absence of, you know, an Axl Rose or a Bono screaming big choruses, this, I mean, I liked it immediately. This is basically guitar rock for the 2010s. Am I wrong?
I mean, I don't know about that.
Is that harsh?
or just because it's the guitar riffs are so growly and unpleasant, but everybody seems to like them?
Pretty much. I mean, it hits all my dude buttons. It makes me want to go, yeah, you know, and put my hat on backwards and rage in the pit.
Yeah, it was a bit of a surprise success. And I still a little bit confused as to, like, was it just something viral that happened on the internet and then it just kind of ran from there? It's one of those genres that without a cadre of really devoted people at the middle of it refusing to give up on it, it might have died out a couple of times by now, but everybody just kind of stuck with it until it morphed into something that is huge.
Was used in 2012. Is it still that big? Because all I ever see is people backlashing and hating on dubstep and making it a joke.
I mean, dubstep just turned into bass, like the bass, okay, which is bigger than, which is one of the biggest components of the dance music scene in North America now. And I think around the world too. I'd have to, you know, I don't want to speak out of turn here, but I know there's tons and tons of bass festivals all around my city. They're big, the big Escapade Canada Day festival, half of that is bass music. And then the big promoters in this city aren't techno or house or trance promoters anymore. They're the bass promoters. They're the ones that are the bringing in the real heat to the city and getting the real numbers. So,
So the sound just evolved a little and they changed the name and kept on trucking.
Exactly. Bass is an offshoot or a catch-all for dubstep and everything else that kind of wubs.
All right. And I like the wubs, as I've said. And I'm not kidding about that. I really do like this stuff. And then the third big thing that he felt Skrillex personified was the transition of electronic music culture from analog to digital and the almost complete integration of dance culture with the internet. Blogs, message boards, social media, podcasts, YouTube, SoundCloud, websites, Beatport, et cetera, et cetera. It totally changed the game as far as how people communicated things, and a lot of gatekeepers lost their place in the puzzle.
Yeah, and a lot of people were putting dubstep into their YouTube videos. All the kids that were up at the new technology and doing stuff, they liked this new sound, and they were propagating it through their content. So I guess it's not surprising that it managed to saturate to a point where enough people heard it that it got critical mass.
Yep. And so then he describes a little bit about how EDM got so big in the States. He talks about the low ebb from 2004, 2005, which he had talked about in the previous chapter. He kind of goes on at more length about that, how there was a period when you'd go to the hippest dance clubs in New York City, and it's a bar with not a very good sound system, and it just didn't get the music across. And he was really pained by that. But he almost seems as pained by the resurgence as by the downfall in this chapter. But by 2010, you know, you're having these newly massive raves, quickly followed by ugly incidents, you know, minors sneaking in and overdosing, bad press. But this followed more like the pattern in the UK in the early 90s, where the bad press fed the popularity rather than, say, the States in the late 90s, where the bad press led to a crackdown that killed the popularity. So interesting how that plays out in different ways at different times. You had big promoters. We mentioned the Hard Crew. You also had Insomniac, Ultra, Electric Zoo, Identity with a capital I and a capital D. Skrillex won 3 Grammys. He was on the cover of Spin and Billboard back when anybody cared about physical magazines, kind of the last days of physical magazines mattering. You had the Ultra Music Fest in Miami that sold 165,000 tickets in 2012, quickly trumped by the Electric Daisy Carnival in Las Vegas, which sold 320,000 tickets for a 3-day concert. So,
big, you know, number.
Yeah, massive. I mean, that will get the attention of any, ticket selling impresario in the music business for sure.
And I guess that's the whole thing, is the big difference between kind of what happened before and how it was stamped down and what happened now. There's two kind of factors to it. The first is that you had the past generation that loved all of this music going from kids into adulthood and being the people in these positions of power and being these people who finally have real jobs and money and everything else like that, being able to maneuver within the system. You had those ugly incidents and you had the bad press. And the decision was made by guys like Insomniac and Ultra to run towards regulation, a term that we're pretty familiar with. And yes, because indeed, they were adults and because they had money, the system didn't buck them off like they did in the past. Now they were actually allowed to integrate in and reform themselves and, you know, be allowed to be taken seriously as businessmen. And instead of the scene being back in like 2004, 2005, big cities would have, you know, raves every other weekend that where there'd be like 1,000 people who would show up, but then you'd also have cops shutting everything down. It was just chaos and there was no reliability. And anytime anybody started to get a scene that was going too well, the cops would come in and completely destroy it. All of a sudden these guys come in and they have protection from the police shutdowns and they have a stability where they aren't losing, you know, $20,000-$30,000 every 3 or 4 events because the city has just decided to like pull their license or whatever else like that. And now things can grow. So, you know, all this talk about, oh, it's actually good when the system kind of fights you because then you get more publicity. Well, yes and no. When the system is actually devoted to shutting you down, they do a pretty good job. And finally, without the system fighting us so hard, this is, I think the scene was always there and it was always burgeoning and it was always trying to get this big. It just wasn't allowed to by the powers that be.
Yeah, absolutely. And once you hit a critical mass where you're drawing 100,000 people or 300,000 people to an event, that gets really hard and inefficient for the cops to try to shut that down. And yeah, they stopped having these festivals. I mean, other than a few things, there's still some festivals out in the deserts, but those have become giant events and legalized. But for the most part, they ran to sports stadiums and motorsports venues, the places where the local government could help control, have intense security and safety provisions, et cetera, so the local politicians can say this is just like any other concert. And also, I think he doesn't mention this, but just the growth of festivals in general, because, you know, Daft Punk's 2006 set at Coachella is cited as the big turning point when EDM became legit. They had played inside a huge glowing pyramid and the whole bit. But that was in the context of Coachella, which had all kinds of artists that were not dance artists. So festivals became a big thing for every kind of musical performer, and EDM was in there. Let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsor. And when we come back, we'll continue to talk about EDM's conquest of America. And so, yeah, so I was talking about Daft Punk's success at Coachella. And, you know, both Skrillex and Deadmau5 modeled their audiovisual approach on that show and created these completely over the top visual and sonic fests with custom video packages for every song, which really limits how much they can improvise, I guess not at all, and locks them into kind of doing the same show every time. But, you know, when you got 100,000 kids that are ready to rage, they want that predictable quality thing. It's kind of similar to what the Rolling Stones have done over the years. You know, you don't see a lot of Keith Richards, Ronnie Wood guitar solos. You hear Mick Jagger putting out the hits the same way every time. So you get, you know, you pay your money, you get what you paid for.
Yeah, there's some elements, like Deadmau5 basically admitted that he was locked in and he just presses play and everything kind of runs off of a DAT, and that's that. Skrillex, I think, for a while was kind of locked in, but his visuals were, you know, the different songs would have different visual packages, but it's not like he wasn't choosing. Skrillex has always been more of a DJ than Deadmau5. Deadmau5 always kind of just said that he's performing his music, while Skrillex has DJ cred, does DJ, mixes it up, doesn't come in with like just a, you know, 1 hour wave file and just play that. But a lot of these festivals did start getting that rigid. I mean, if you have pyro connected to stuff, you know, it would make sense that you could just press the pyro button at the right time. But if you're trying to get the explosions to time right with the drop of the music, then it starts to get to the point where you need to really take out any kind of flexibility that you have. So it's kind of gone back and forth. I think 2015, it was very locked in. A lot of these guys were coming in playing the same sets over and over. Now you've got to return to more flexibility and not being locked in, and people really kind of castigating the people who are fake playing.
Yeah, and Skrillex does a lot of stuff with his audiovisual that is more flexible and allows him to improvise, like casting, you know, wearing a light suit that casts shadows on the big screen so he can move and improvise the visuals as well as the songs. And then Reynolds talks about one kind of irony of this is that the key to the popularity in this era was this experiential aspect of having to be there, of having to pay the ticket, go to Coachella, go to the Electronic Daisy Festival, and be there in real time with real people, which is kind of ironic in the digital age. And that leads him to a whole discussion of Skrillex's management. And I thought this was interesting. The Blood Company, they're hardcore metal specialists. Bands like Atreyu, Revoker, is where they made their bread and butter. And they were the first people to just kind of take the old school. And this is something that's rock bands have been doing since the early 70s. I mean, this is literally the game plan of Bad Company and Dinosaurs Like That. Get in the bus and go to every town in America, every college town, every mid-sized city, you know, play your Des Moines, Iowa, play your Amarillo, Texas, play your Lubbock, Texas, get out there, get on the road, get in front of people. And they discovered that these EDM acts were a lot easier and cheaper than a rock band. You've got one performer, one or two support people. A lot of the sound is preset. You don't have to have technicians for mics. You don't have to have guitar tuners. You don't have to have a drum tech, et cetera, et cetera. So just a couple light people, just a couple, you know, roadies to carry the gear, your performer, and, you know, and it becomes the main source of touring, of performer revenue, because MP3s, you know, by this point, iTunes has come along and people are buying MP3s. The streaming services are coming online, although they're not massively popular yet. But no, there's no two ways around it, that album sales or music sales were no longer the central revenue source for musicians. That the glory days of the 90s, when they were selling $20 CDs because people wanted to buy one song with these massive profit margins and plenty of money to go around, those days are over, and now performers are really having to grind to make their dough.
Yeah, and they're not just a big staple of early 2000 DJing was basically you're a DJ, you have a hit, your manager is fielding requests from random promoters across America or the UK or wherever your influence is growing, and you kind of try to weed out the super sketchy ones, but you're basically getting on a plane going who knows where to play for who knows who in front of who knows what crowd. now around 2010, you've got the bigger artists setting up their whole tours. You got, as we were talking about, Skrillex taking a hands-on approach to making sure that he's not just going to towns where there are promoters that are ready to do the legwork for him. He's going and doing, booking up all these venues and basically hitting up all of the different spaces. So these industries are taking it more upon themselves to run this whole operation, as opposed to before, where you had promoters, sketchy or not, more often sketchy than not, just randomly booking you in an odd spot, and maybe you trying to pick another place or two that you can play before your plane ticket takes you back home.
Yeah, just more doing the grind and conquering that territory. Then he talks about dubstep's conquest of America, and that one of the key moments was the September 2006 Radio 1 show, The Dubstep Wars, hosted by Marianne Hobbs. And he says that all the key DJs in the scene were on this special session. Mala, Scream, Code 9, Vexed, DJ Hatcha, Lofa, Distance. They were talking about the music and the culture. It really painted a picture of what dubstep meant. That show was traded throughout the internet to the point where it's almost a cliche to say that it influenced you. So a real Johnny Appleseed moment, and the use of the internet to spread this scene far and wide. Like there was a forum, the dubstep forum, that they plugged on that show that went from a few hundred users when the show went live to over a million in 2013. So the internet is removing kind of these time lags that had separated geographically disparate scenes. Like in the jungle era, American fans and DJs could not get their hands on the records. The white labels would take months to come out and then come across the Atlantic. And by that time, jungle had moved on. You couldn't hear the pirate radio unless you were in London, or, you know, you're waiting in the mail for a cassette copy of pirate radio broadcasts to arrive. The internet killed all that. No more waiting months. You could hear the latest tracks right away and really changed the music.
Yeah, it was really a big deal because underground dance music had become kind of constipated because you had DJs who wanted secret weapons and they would hold on to tracks and play them. I remember as a trance DJ being real cheesed off at the fact that if you wanted to play what the other top DJs were playing, you had to wait 3 to 6 months for them to play these tracks into the ground before they would actually release them on their labels. And of course, the piracy and digital files and stuff like that were the solution to getting everything to flow a little bit more equitably.
Yeah, and this goes back all the way to, you know, Jamaica and some of the very first episodes we did in the first series where, you know, those impresarios of the Jamaican sound system would print up their own records and not share them with anybody else. And so there's always been this kind of tension of spreading the music or controlling it so that you can really blow away the crowd with something they can't hear anywhere else. And then he talks about this weird evolution that dubstep had, where it evolved from a connoisseur sound to a populist favorite, and that the rise of the wobble, the wise of the wobble, was the key moment. And it's interesting because in the last chapter, he had talked about dubstep, and he was like, what I'm missing is what's the big single idea of dubstep? And it turned out to be the wobble.
Absolutely.
And, you know, key tracks like Scream's Oscalata and Cokie's SpongeBob, which morphs SpongeBob's voice into the bass part, you know, were key parts of, you know, that's kind of the wobble sound in essence. And now it's time to cue again. And this is a little off topic, but we'll introduce it and we'll play it and then let Ryan explain after we hear it why he picked this one. This is Diplo featuring Nikki DeBee, Express Yourself from 2012. And that was Diplo featuring Nikki DeBee, Express Yourself. Why did you pick that one?
Oh, well, we're not quite there yet, but we do end up starting to talk a little bit about Diplo and Ghetto Tech, and Ghetto Tech kind of leads into Trap and leads into Future Sound and everything else like that. So this is just a slice of Ghetto Tech from 2012 when Simon Reynolds, you know, kind of staked down this chapter to give you an idea of the very different kind of Latin influenced grimy stuff that was being put out by some of these top names at the time.
Yeah, there's other things going on than just Brostep in this period, and then we have to rush a little bit and get to covering him. But he's talking about this weird inversion where dubstep goes from being an underground sound for, you know, nose in the air connoisseurs in a very localized area of South London to this international populist sensation. And he talks about one of the key moments was that it took over the crusty rave and squatter scenes, and also the hippie jam band scene in the US, where, you know, Phish fans and stuff had kind of kept the legacy of the Grateful Dead alive. And, you know, everywhere else in the world, electronic music took over that psychedelic scene, you know, from Goa, India to Ibiza, everywhere else. And took over from the old electric guitar jam bands. But the States were the last holdout. And this is the period. And dubstep was kind of the sound that helped in that. In the rest of the world, psytrance and acid techno had ruled the crusty rave scenes. But no more. Dubstep took over. And they found that wobble step went well with ketamine, which is the new drug of choice. Ketamine, a dissociative drug, closely related to PCP or angel dust. Very interesting, because PCP was a pet tranquilizer that got out to the Hell's Angels and got a really burly negative reputation, whereas ketamine was held closely by doctors and nurses and used as a special treat by professionals. But they both have the same effect, which is to sort of make you feel like you're not in your body. It's not an upper, it's not a downer, it's not a hallucinogen, it's a dissociative drug. And it goes great with wobble step, apparently.
I mean, surprised me is how it kind of got into the party scene, considering it's not much of a party drug. I always get confused when these, you know, you're at a party and people are doing drugs that basically tranquilize you, knock you out and put you out on the couch, like ketamine and GHB, if dosed just right, can hit a point where you can, you know, feel pretty good and the music sounds pretty good, but you go just a little bit over that and you're either unconscious or you're a two-dimensional piece of atomic matter.
Yeah. And a lot of people complain about
toilet flushing, or it could be amazing music. It would sound great to you.
And a lot of people complain about the K zombie staggering around and ruining the scene. But he goes back to this thing where dubstep transforms itself into a hardcore scene in two senses, he says. A genre that had always felt diffuse developed in the wobble a stylistic hardcore. And that new focus and sound was accompanied by the rise of a hardcore mentality. 6 years into its existence, dubstep became a headstrong, having it off scene with a following of punters, not just pundits and scholars. It's the reverse of what usually happens with music. And that's why it's kind of fascinating to me. I don't know of any other instance where a scene has gone this way. Typically, the center doesn't hold. Fragmentation sets in, accelerated by the fusionization of the style with adjacent genres. The music gets mature and refined, genteel and a bit gutless. It loses the populist audience, gets artsy, and loses the young audience. But the total opposite happened with dubstep. Instead of growing up, dubstep grew down, age-wise and in terms of sophistication. Whether that's evolution or devolution has been the big crux of dissension these last 4 years. And then, you know, he talks about people like Casper and Rusko, who are big popularizers with tracks like Cockney Thug and Well Ard, you know, and this micro-edited, timbrely warped bass line had become the new axis of innovation, taking the place once occupied by breakbeat science and jungle. And where jungle had Cubase software, dubstep had Massive by Native Instruments, which was a synth plugin for your digital audio workstation and would allow you to make those kind of what ultimately became the big Skrillex sound. He cites DJ Excision's 2008 Shambhala Festival mix was a key moment in the North American breakthrough. That mix got passed around all over the place because it isolated the most aggressive industrial sounding tracks around. And that's where this kind of hard rock thing, you know, was formalized and really took off. And you know, then you get things like He says it became a generational sound for young Americans designed to piss off parents. And he recommends watching the elders react to dubstep video on YouTube, which is it's a delight to see the old folks just freaking out over this stuff. And of course, there's a backlash. Reynolds calls it the new NUIDM, intelligent dance music. And he was sort of staggered to see some of the same old arguments that had been rolled out against hardcore back in 1992 used once again. But he does admit that it made for a lot of good listening, a lot of good albums by people like Darkstar, Coolie G, and Code 9 on the Hyperdub label. You also had the Hessel Audio, Hot Flush. And then you had these other artists like Flying Lotus, Actress, and the Hudson Mohawk from all over the world who were coming in from techno or weird hop backgrounds. And weird hop is like backpack rap or whatever, like, you know, J Dilla disciples who are into the artsy edge of hip hop, you know, the DJ Shadow kind of Jurassic 5 kind of thing, that artsy end of hip hop that bleeds over into dance music. And let's see. And then he gets into this sort of lost in the mist, this whole era of, you know, he wrote a book called Retromania about what happened in the rock scene, where the past became so dominant that it really sort of impeded new rock music from making a big impact. And he's arguing that the same thing was happening in aspects of the electronic music scene, not so much the dance scene, but the sort of bedroom music makers, that people had so much history and so much geography at their fingertips that it was hard to create a conversation with the current moment. You think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, this to me was the real post-genre era. There was a whole bunch of stuff that I just qualify as blocktronica because it doesn't fit any kind of label. You couldn't put it out on a label. The reason that dubstep managed to specialize in so many different directions is they had so many different record labels, or, you know, digital record labels, however you want to describe it these days, putting out a specific sound. But you have all of these disparate people, all these producers who aren't even maybe trying to create dance music, but it just ends up having a bit of a groove to it, creating and releasing stuff that doesn't fit anywhere and wouldn't get any attention or any place where it could release itself if it wasn't for just blogs capable of picking up stuff out in the real left field of the spectrum and putting it in front of everybody. And then I put like stuff like what James Blake was doing early on as being something like that, because it really was just kind of like 16 channels of James Blake humming a bunch of different melodies. And then somebody remixes it with a bit of a beat and a bass to it. And all of a sudden we got a new kind of dance genre, but what is it? So there was a lot of stuff that was going on. A lot of it didn't fit. A lot of it fit what had come before, and a lot of it absorbed backwards from hip hop production or from pop production or just from strange ambient spaces.
Yeah, kind of a Tower of Babel era, I would say. And then this is our last song. This is Blackout Crew, Put a Donk on It. Now put a donk on it. Electro. Oh, that's sick, that mate. Put a donk on it. Techno. Oh, no, that is good. Put a donk on it. Hey, that's good, that, Tony. Ah, sick. And that was Blackout Crew's Put a Donk on It. Tell us about this one. I'm not even sure we'll get to this topic, but
yeah, we've jumped now to, we haven't even gotten to Ghetto Tech, and we're jumping all the way forward to discuss some of the weird stuff going on with the underground hard dance scene. And Put a Donk on It is kind of a novelty track that once again jokes around. When we were talking about breakcore, we played a novelty breakcore track that kind of explained breakcore in the music itself, and Put a Donk on It kind of explains how donk music is just the distillation of hard house gone all the way down to hell and back.
And it's pretty funny. But let's talk about global ghetto tech. Reynolds says it's an umbrella term for party hard sounds like karaoke funk, reggaeton, kwaito, kumbaya, kuduro, and forgive my pronunciation on these, kuptikal, guaca. Do you have any idea how to say Decom?
I'm not sure if that's a real, if that is that the real word, or did you?
That is the real word. It's a South African music. I ran across it when I was down there, but I don't know how to pronounce it. I've only seen it in print. But, you know, music, sounds that emerge from the slums of Brazil, Puerto Rico, South Africa, Colombia, Angola, Ivory Coast, Guadeloupe. These exotic dance genres share one quality, impurity. They're bastard and Creole children based in the sound clash of folk forms with Western styles like hip hop, house, and techno. So tons of fun stuff going on, kind of a global melting pot going on. He says that DJs like Diplo, Rupture, and Mosca play tracks from these remote subcultures in their sets, but they also create tracks influenced by these styles of roughneck exotica. Sometimes they manage to create a whole new post-geographical genre, like Moombaton, a hybrid of reggaeton and Dutch house, which spawned neither in Puerto Rico nor Holland, but in Washington, D.C., by the DJ producer Dave Nada. So, yeah, the internet is allowing people to hear stuff that historically would have taken a long time to travel. And you know, all these flavors and cultures are getting mixed and matched. Also, the American ghettos are continuing to be fertile sources of bass-heavy hybrids of gangster rap, electro, and techno, such as Hi-Fi from Oakland, Jerk from L.A., New Jersey Club, and Baltimore Breaks. He singles out the Chicago street sound known as footwork as a particular favorite, something particularly interesting, assimilated by producers like Addison Grove, evolved from a mutant offshoot of Chicago house called Juke, but it's more influenced by booty bass than four on the floor. So the, you know, the old Two Live Crew electro sound. And the dancers are gladiatorial, like break dancers. They're not lost in a crowd. It's not like jack dancing where it's a whole bunch of people jacking and communally getting off together. It's like break dancing where it's individuals showing off and kind of competing with each other. And he says footwork is a prime proof of a recurring truth in dance music, the functional styles that generally produce the real breakthroughs. So stuff people are really dancing to on the streets is where you get interesting stuff. Then he talks about bassline, which is a North of England style that descended from the wah-wah bass of Gant, 187 Lockdown, and DJ Narrows. You had producers like T2, Mr. V, and DJ Q developing a style, quote, based around ridiculously ornate sculpting of the bassline. And this was one of the first genres to seize YouTube's potential because they didn't have the pirate radio up north. You even had a couple of pop hits like Heartbroken by T2 and What's It Gonna Be by H2O. Then you've got Donk out of Liverpool, which we played a little bit. It's related to Scouse House, Scouse being the people of Liverpool, a, quote, clanking pipe, plank-like percussion sound usually placed midway between the beats and giving the tracks a twangy bounce vaguely redolent of 80s high energy. And we played Blackout Cruise, put a Donk on it. Then he talked about Funky, which is an East London sound that didn't catch on beyond its local area. And he ultimately felt like it was too local, too customized for what the people in East London wanted to hear, but not distinctive enough to grab global attention. So any final thoughts as we wrap up this section? I had to rush through all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a grab bag, but I feel like you can kind of throw ghetto tech and some of the stuff that we're talking about with the Chicago stuff. We're finally getting away. The number of times that we've talked in this over various chapters about the white sound and the black sound, I feel like so many times when we're talking about black funk, it goes back to disco and a Chicago or a Philadelphia sound. And all of a sudden, finally, with ghetto tech, you're starting to hear sounds from Brazil, Puerto Rico, lots of South America stuff, lots of Caribbean stuff, the ass shaking funky stuff. Come back in. So I feel like we, for a long time, we were talking about white and black, but I feel like now we're getting really international and we're finding funk in different places that we might not have expected beforehand. Now, as far as, what was kind of going on with gangster rap back turning into dance music as well, you got to look into trap music. Trap music, had a really interesting percussive sound to it and became a pretty big thing for a hot minute before it got basically swallowed and dissolved into all dance music around 2015.
Yeah, and he also talks about how hip hop had kind of, you know, the hip hop R&B alliance with Timbaland, we talked about that, had kind of conquered the dance scene in the early 2000s. And then in the later 2000s and 2010s, the Euro scene comes roaring in and suddenly – is on the pop charts in America, even though it's not straight instrumental tracks. It feature, you know, it's all your pop suspects were suddenly doing remixes with people like David Guetta and Calvin Harris, et cetera. And, you know, all your Britneys and all the Lady Gagas and Madonnas, everybody, you know, Drake, were doing these remixes with this Euro style. So, you know, pretty fascinating. And you had producers like will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas, Dr. Luke of Keisha fame, and others that were copying the style as well. So, you know, and then you had, of course, the great LMFAO, the grandsons of Berry Gordy, and their party rock anthem. But then one last thing I want to get to is he talks about this sort of inversion of the 90s dance ethos with what was happening in the 2010s. He says the three big things of the 90s were all absent in this scene, and they were the belief in the underground, a neo-do-it-yourself ethos of self-organizing bottom-up grassroots cultures, drugs as a consciousness-raising and socially healing force expressed in America through the slogan PLUR. What's PLUR stand for?
Peace, love, unity, and respect.
All right. And the idea of the future, that electronic music was future music that was in the advance or avant-garde of mainstream pop that would keep evolving and mutating, but also that the idea that the music and culture together constituted a social vanguard of some kind. And he says that in the 2010s, that all of those aspects were absent. And in particular, this futurism was gone and that it had been replaced by sort of a YOLO, you only live once, kind of nowism. And he says nowism is kind of an analog for no future, the Sex Pistols old slogan, and that people, you know, the millennials and the Zoomers have been through multiple economic collapses, a dramatic shrinking of economic opportunity, serious social dislocation, and the ideology of futurism just isn't playing for the younger people of today, and they're living in the moment. And also, the technology has become so ubiquitous, it's not novel anymore to have robo sounds. We're all part of the machine. And so what's happening is this integration of the human and the electronic is pretty much complete. So did EDM win in the end or what?
Maybe for now. And again, what's going on in the mainstream doesn't really represent what's happening in the underground. I 100% agree with the three points that he puts out. I think it was a really good way to wrap up a chapter that at times was a bit of a frenzied grab bag, but he really nailed kind of the difference in what was going on, because I came into the rave scene with that do-it-yourself ethos, and it really blew me away about a year into it, where I was just thinking, you know, you're into rock, you can't book the Rolling Stones, but if you're into dance music, you could book whoever you want. And now that's not really the case anymore. And you know, I'm really happy that the scene has exploded to the point where we can, you know, some people can rent arenas, but it also comes with the backlash that anything being done in a warehouse looks just that much more illegal. And it's really kind of the big, just like everything else in American society, it's the big guys that are winning out and the small people are being crushed and pushed out.
And yeah, that seems to be the way of, you know, the world at this particular point in time. So the little guys are getting crushed all over the place, including in the musical world. And that's it for our discussion of Simon Reynolds' Energy Flash, A Journey Through Rave Music and Dance Culture, which I think this is the 22nd installment. And we'll be back next week with Mr. Reynolds himself. And we're going to get to interview him and ask him some questions. So Ryan, sharpen those pencils and put the thinking cap on, and let's put Mr. Reynolds through his paces.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Next week, Nate and Ryan will be back with Simon Reynolds himself to get answers to their questions about Energy Flash and the history of rave music and dance culture. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.